It is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. We turn to Wisconsin Public Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson to help us with context on the latest developments in state politics. Call in with questions about legislative issues and what you're wondering about in the state Supreme Court race. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sean, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, so the Supreme Court race could shift power in the high court. This race is heating up. Talk about what is now unfolding in the race as we're about 3 weeks away from the April 4th election.
I think what you're seeing in the race at this point is a massive ad war kind of starting to take shape, especially, for a spring officially nonpartisan Supreme Court race. The amount of money flowing to Wisconsin right now kind of reflects the fact that it is one of, if not the most important races in the country this year. And so huge money is flowing here, and you're seeing that part of the campaign play out in front of you. You're not seeing the candidates going around the state debating because turns out they're only going to have one of those debates before the election on March 21st, before the State Bar Association. And you're also not seeing what's happening behind the scenes right now for the campaigns, really, which is a turnout operation, trying to get their voters out there for a race that's going to have high turnout, really high turnout for a Supreme Court race. But I think what you would consider low turnout if it was like a race for governor or a race for president, this going after more dedicated voters in a race like this.
Okay, let's turn to the messaging and what's before our eyeballs. What are the candidates saying in these ads?
Well, what you're seeing from Judge Jana Protasiewicz, that the candidate who's supported by Democrats, is she's painting her opponent, former Justice Dan Kelly, the candidate supported by Republicans, as extreme. She's saying that, she's pointing out that he worked for an anti-abortion group. One of her recent ads said he's for sale, really trying to paint him in a way that, potential Democratic voters are going to know kind of who's who in this race. And, I guess also try to steer independent voters or, those people who maybe haven't made up their minds to vote in an election like this, to steer them away from him by hitting him on issues that are, popular issues, I guess, trying to paint him as the anti-abortion candidate in the race in a big way.
And let's listen to part of an ad from Jana Protasiewicz criticizing candidate Dan Kelly over this case he planned to hear where the plaintiff was a campaign donor.
What does it cost to buy off a judge? For extremist Dan Kelly, he's for sale for $20,000. In 2020, Kelly conveniently changed his mind about whether to judge the Tim Zegnego case. Kelly had recused himself. Then he pocketed $20,000 in contributions from Zegnego and his family, and Kelly unrecused himself so he could judge the case.
Okay, so you kind of have to listen closely to the details of this ad. How do you is former Justice Dan Kelly responding to this issue over recusal?
Yeah, I mean, the details of this case, we could have a very long list here, Kate, of all the procedural steps that this case took. But it might jog your memory to just remember this was what we called the voter purge case a lot in 2019, in 2020, and 2021. It was filed by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, or WIL. The person referenced in the ads, Timothy Zegnego, was the plaintiff in the case. His family gave a total of $20,000 to Dan Kelly in 2019 and 2020. So what happened is Kelly wasn't going to hear the case before his election in 2020. Then he lost in 2020 and he announced that he would hear the case. Kelly is basically saying in response to this latest Protasiewicz ad that she's ignoring those details. Actually, but I mean, he's saying it in pretty harsh terms in a written statement that he gave us, called Jana Protasiewicz, quote, a liar, quote, disgrace to the judiciary. I mean, these are pretty strong terms. We get used to saying pretty strong terms in in politics in the year 2023. But I would say,
but on the bench,
even in a judicial race, I would say that this is going into pretty strong terms between these candidates. You know, Judge Protase was saying former Justice Kelly is for sale, and Kelly calling her a serial liar and a disgrace to the judiciary. That's where the candidates are at right now.
Talking about state politics and the state Supreme Court race with WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson as our guide, you can join in the conversation. Your questions and comments welcome at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's look at what Kelly is saying in one of these ads. The state's largest business lobby is Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. And so here's part of an ad from that group criticizing Judge Protasewicz over her handling of criminal cases.
Sexual assault of an 11-year-old. No prison time. He raped a military veteran, left her for dead just 2.5 years. Raped a mentally disabled 14-year-old. Probation. How the heck did this happen? Janet Protasewicz.
If you could go back in time, would you have ruled any differently?
I would say no.
Okay, so looking at her rulings, how is Protasewicz responding to this?
I guess in general, we'll say, she's saying that these attacks coming from WMC and others are they're attacking a record that I guess she stands by. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get you the exact quote here from them. Right-wing groups, this is from Protasewicz's campaign, quote, right-wing groups are desperate to mislead voters about a record because they know Dan Kelly has never been a judge, full-time prosecutor, or sentenced anyone to prison. So you see kind of these in a Supreme Court race, there's kind of an adage that you don't need to be a judge to run for Supreme Court, but you kind of need to be a judge. And so candidates who run for the court typically have experience as a judge so that when they can, you know, run for the court, they can wear those robes in the ads and say, hey, I've done this before. And it's a formula that works. There's another formula that works in attacks, and in that, you know, when you have been a judge, you have heard any number of cases and you have a record. And so groups like WMC find cases where they argue the sentences are too light. They throw them up in 30-second ads. And so you're kind of seeing that formula play out. Her response here is that Justice Kelly, while he has been a justice, he has not been a judge. And so they're pointing that out, that she has experience as a prosecutor and judge that he never had.
Well, Kelly, having served on the high court from 2016 to 2020, what has Kelly done since he lost re-election to the high court in 2020?
He has been a lawyer for a variety of, I think, Republican causes, including the Republican Party, advised them, you know, in the wake of the 2020 election. You know, he was mentioned in former state GOP chair Andrew Hitt's testimony before the January 6th commission, you know, talking about consulting with Dan Kelly. You know, Justice Kelly has kind of minimized the amount of consulting that went on there, described it as kind of like a, I think, like a half hour conversation or something with Andrew Hitt, the former state GOP chair. You know, Dan Kelly has always been involved with Republicans and Republican groups in his private law practice. And that didn't stop after he left the court and before this latest campaign.
And just quickly here, what does the Republican Party of Wisconsin, you know, we've seen such enthusiastic backing. Why does the party fully back Kelly?
I mean, he has been, I guess, part of the party's apparatus for a while now. Mm. And you have an extremely partisan campaign here this time around where, I mean, just Judge Protasewicz's biggest donor is the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. And, you know, they're making, enabling her to kind of take control of the TV ad war messaging here because she is the largest spender. So on the Republican side, the Republican Party hasn't done the same thing for Dan Kelly. They support him. But he's getting his financial backing from groups like WMC and from groups that are funded by Richard Uihlein, a GOP mega donor.
Let's bring in Jeff in Delafield. Jeff, what is your reaction to this race?
Yes, one of the narratives that's been out there is that candidate Protasewicz has telegraphed how she'll come down on cases that might come before her if elected to the Supreme Court. And if she's done that, how unusual is that? The narrative is, well, that's never been done before. This is a new for a Supreme Court candidate. Has this ever been done before if she's indeed done that? Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate it. Sean.
So whenever you're talking about the language that candidates use as they campaign, there's a certain amount of, I think, subjectivity that comes when you try to measure that, right? I would say that Judge Protasiewicz has, in very stark terms, talked about her values, and she always phrases it in those terms when it comes to, abortion. You know, she believes in a woman's right to choose. She has described our state's Republican-drawn redistricting plan as rigged, which is a very strong term to describe a map that could come before the court. She tempers it each time by saying, to be clear, I'm not saying how I would rule in these cases, but, you know, she's certainly sending a message to prospective voters about where she's starting when it comes to these things.
Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief, been covering state politics here for nearly 20 years. Call in with questions, thoughts, anytime, 800-642-1234. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief, Sean Johnson, as our guide to look at recent political developments amid budget writing season. Call in with your questions, your comments about state politics in the 106th Wisconsin Legislature. March floor session gets underway tomorrow. Number to call is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's look to the Brewers now, Sean. As part of the state budget plan, Governor Evers urging $290 million for stadium upgrades to keep the Brewers in Milwaukee. But we've also seen Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss now calling the proposal likely dead. What is at stake here? What are the circumstances?
I think what's at stake here, if you look at the way the governor framed this issue when he introduced the Brewers plan, is that he wants to keep the Brewers in town. He doesn't want them to leave. You haven't heard them kind of make threats like that out in the open. But when the governor introduced this plan, he says, we got to keep Major League Baseball here in Milwaukee for another 20 years. So he's framing it that way, that if we don't do something and we don't find a way for the Brewers to update their stadium, then the Brewers could leave. There is some time, though, because the Brewers lease lasts a few more years yet. And so it's not like this is the year that there absolutely has to be a deal necessarily. But what you have is a massive budget surplus this year. There's a lot of money right now in state government's general fund. And the governor wants to spend $290 million of it on improvements to Milwaukee Brewers Stadium. What you're seeing now from Republicans is, I think, like what you could have entirely predicted about this legislative process, is that they're saying that deal is not going to be it. You know, that they're not ruling out. And when I say they, we're really talking about Assembly Speaker Robin Voss here, who kind of talked about it recently. They're not ruling out a deal for the Brewers, but the one that the governor laid out is not what they're going to embrace. And they kind of look back at what happened with the Bucks Stadium, the Bucks Arena, which was, you know, 8 years ago now, as their guide for how this should move forward. And, you know, Speaker Voss was very involved in those negotiations.
Right. I mean, what is the tension around using public money on privately owned sports teams and their infrastructure?
I think if you take just like a 40,000 foot view of the issue among the public when this gets polled. Now, I'm not talking about like there's not been polling on the Brewers stadium. But by and large, when you see the public polled about, you know, should the state step in and spend X amount of dollars on an arena for these professional sports franchises, which are typically owned by wealthy people, doesn't always poll well. But people like the Brewers, people like the Bucks, they don't want their teams to disappear. And so there's that tension there. No, I don't think any governor would want to be in charge when a sports team left Wisconsin. And, you know, Speaker Voss hasn't given any indication that he would want to be blamed for that either. There's a little political tension there. I mean, they don't want the Brewers to leave town. They also don't want to hand Evers a huge win potentially. So they have to figure out a deal that everybody can get behind.
And so we'll just have to wait on what that new iteration would entail. I'm going to just reintroduce you here as we talk state politics with WPR's Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. You can join in with your questions along the way at 800-642-1234. Let's turn now to toll roads, Sean. You know, once again, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss says he wants to renew advocating for our state to adopt a tolling system that would fund roads and bridges. Where is the governor on the idea of tolling?
He didn't. I mean, I think it's safe to say now, with a few budgets under his belt, that the governor is not itching to implement tolling in Wisconsin. I think it was an open question when he first took office. And actually, you did hear a few years ago, before the governor had introduced his first budget, you heard Speaker Voss support tolling. You heard then Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald support tolling. They had kind of tussled with former Republican Governor Scott Walker over the issue, because Walker vetoed a $2.5 million tolling study that probably would have led to tolling in Wisconsin. And so I think in 2019, it was kind of an open question of where is Governor Evers when it comes to tolling. I think in the year 2023, that's less of an open question. He did not introduce it in his budget this time or in the last two times. And I think Evers, often when he talks about roads, he says like all options or something I'll consider, but it's not, tolling is a big step. And, you know, we haven't seen any indication from the governor that it's one he wants to take.
Let's just take a moment here to hear from former State Department of Transportation Secretary Mark Gottlieb, who spoke against tolls on WPR's Central Time.
What's being talked about in Wisconsin is fairly unique, and that is we're talking about converting highways that started out as non-tolled facilities into tolled facilities. And, you know, most tolled roads that you drive on, you go to Illinois or Indiana Turnpike, Ohio Turnpike, those are highways that were built, designed, conceived, and built to be toll roads.
Okay, so the roads we're talking about, not designed and built to be toll roads. Have Republicans brought that up at all?
I don't think that you haven't seen this issue, like, take hold this session.
Okay.
You heard Speaker Voss, when he talked about tolling, he talked about it before the Wisconsin Counties Association, where they're talking about how do we fund roads at large. And Voss could say, and he can say this, you know, I've been saying for a decade, I was just looking back in our archives, Kate, and the first story I did about Robin Voss supporting tolling was in 2012. So he's been saying it for a while, and he can get up there and say, look, I've been in support of a long-term funding source for our roads. But you're not seeing that. I mean, Republicans really haven't started building their alternative to the governor's budget yet. They might be working on it a little bit, but you haven't seen pieces of it come out.
And that's what I'm curious about. What are you watching for next as budget season soldiers on here?
I think what you're going to see in the next couple months, in April, there's going to be four public hearings around the state. But I think the big development that you're kind of watching for here is, what do Republicans think the number is in terms of how much money the state has to work with? Because you've heard Voss, you've heard other Republicans say this $7 billion surplus that the governor's talking about, you know, a lot of that's one-time money. So we can't build a budget based on one-time money with ongoing expenses. And, you know, Evers' budget would leave a large structural deficit if you did everything that he wanted to do the way he wants to do it. But we don't know what Republicans think the number is that they are comfortable working with. You know, how much ongoing, surplus do we have in Wisconsin? Because they've thrown out a few different numbers. and they're still kind of settling on where they are when it comes to those negotiations. I think it's less than what the governor has said, and you know, we'll see what that is. And if they don't think we have enough ongoing money to support all the stuff the governor wants to do, what do you do with this mountain of cash in the general fund? Mm-hmm. Does it just sit there? What's an okay one-time expense to use it on? We haven't heard the guy from Republicans on kind of what's okay to spend one time yet.
Sean, thanks for getting us up to speed.
Thanks, Kate.
Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief. This is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss the cherished French baguette and how to craft European pastries. Call in about French breads, desserts that transport you to Paris. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Jean Webb, owner and head baker of North Shore Boulangerie. And let's take call now. Jeff in Milwaukee. Jeff, hi.
Hi. So my question is about, like, when to visit a boulangerie. I'm assuming that a bunch of bread comes out of the oven in the morning, but is there, like, another shift of baking that gets done? So, you know, when would you suggest coming by to get the best bread?
Jeff, thank you so much. Gene?
You know, when your bakery is kind of operating on a classy schedule, first thing in the morning is the best time. And especially for a baguette, you know, the long shape where there's a high surface to volume ratio, they dry very quickly. They're not a bread with a very long shelf life. So first thing in the morning, you know, a baguette shouldn't be eaten straight out of the oven. That's something you do with American style bread. French breads need to sit on a wire rack for an hour or 2 hours, but usually the baguettes are out of the oven at least that long, maybe 2 hours before the shop opens, and then the baguettes are ready to go. The crust is at its crispiest, all the flavor from that browning reaction on the surface has worked its way into the crumb. Excess moisture from the crumb has worked its way out, and the crust has recrisped itself. It happens quite naturally. And so in those first couple hours when the bakery's open, it's the best time to go get a baguette. Some bakeries, if they're large enough, and we're not a huge bakery, they can sometimes do a second round of baking, but by and large, we don't. There is sometimes people will re-crisp a baguette, and that's something you can do at home quite nicely.
Yes. But yeah, how would you suggest reviving a baguette that's gone a little hard?
Well, once it's hard, it's almost over.
Okay. The relationship is no good anymore.
Right. You've got croutons at that point, okay, or crostini. But if the baguette has gone a little soft, which depending on the time of year, right in August, that often happens. If your hydration level is a little bit high, the excess moisture can come out and soften the crust again a couple hours later. Toss it into a hot oven. What I tell customers is that, you know, 400 degrees, 350, 400 degrees, and hold it in your oven until you start to see a little additional color coming on. If you see additional color coming on, pull it out. But then again, let it rest for an hour or so before you try to serve it.
Can we introduce the freezer here? Is there a best way to freeze dough or to preserve it for future baking?
The dough itself, no. Okay. The baked product. There are doughs that can be frozen. I've never tried to freeze baguette dough. I'm afraid that would the impact on the yeast would be too detrimental. The proofing and everything would probably be bad or not sufficient to get you what you want. But if you have a bag that's on the lighter side and you want to hang on to it, you know, wrap it up very tightly so that, you know, today we have frost-free freezers, which means they're pulling moisture out of the freezer cabinet and they'll pull moisture out of your whatever you put in it unless you wrap it up real well. And then you can hang on to it. Bread freezes quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And then bring it out. Baguettes, you sometimes can go straight from freezer to oven because they're thin enough and small enough for the heat to penetrate. Larger shaped breads probably should bring to room temperature before you try to put them back in the oven.
Okay, good to know. My colleague Trina wrote in a really wonderful note, has been making baguettes almost every week since they went to France at the end of last year, making them using a gluten-free brown rice sourdough starter, psyllium husk, brown rice flour, potato starch, olive oil, and salt, and says, gotta have the baguette pan for ultimate crispness. Can you talk about adapting the traditional baguette for gluten-free or other sensitive diets?
Right. The set of adjustments that you just described would probably absolutely require the use of a baguette pan, those shaped pans that have their troughs that are perforated.
Mm-hmm.
But classically baguettes, and that's because the recipe that you just described is probably on the weaker side. The dough doesn't have a lot of strength, so it needs a pan to provide its shape until it can be baked. Classically, baguettes are not done in pans like that. They're proofed on what's called couche, which is French for diaper. It's a cloth, a floured cloth. So it has to be able to hold itself up even during the proofing process. But it also, once it goes into the oven, it has to hold itself up. It goes the dough directly onto the stone without any support around it. So when you make those sort of adjustments and you do those sorts of things because the dough would be a little bit weaker and would require some support. But yeah, it's
possible.
It is possible. You just make further adjustments.
You mentioned mixers a little bit ago. What utensils or what is really helpful to have on hand when making baguettes?
I think one of the mixers, a mixer with a good strong motor, if you're going to do this frequently. A lot of the mixers today that are on the commercial market for home use have lighter weight motors because for most people, they're just doing batters and meringues, which don't take much power. So try to get a good quality mixer. If you can get a dough hook that is not rounded but is flat, that's helpful also. It is a flatter dough hook can actually grab the dough as it's mixing and stretch it, which is really what creates the strength. This is going to sound silly, but one of the most important things is once you have a baguette proof, you somehow have to get it into the oven. And you're working with basically this soft, delicate, really, really delicate noodle, large noodle, right? So you've got to be able to maneuver around the kitchen. So get a baguette flipper, or you can go to Home Depot and get a long flat board and be able to move your baguette around that way. The most frustrating, I think, at home is when you've gone through this entire process and there you have this beautifully proofed baguette loaf that is
a work of art,
something longer than 20 inches long, and you have to stand there and figure out how you're going to get this unwieldy thing into the oven without destroying it. Even probably more important than the mixer is to have some way to get that baguette into the oven onto the stone.
My blood pressure is going up as you say that. We're talking about French baguettes and baking with Jean Webb, French-trained baker in the greater Milwaukee area, business owner. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Christina in Glenwood City. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. Can you describe the French sablé cookie and offer advice or even a quick recipe to make them to perfection?
Sablé cookies, yes. you know, it's a sort of shortbread. We make a sablé every sablé stars, but we just made a whole bunch of them for the holidays. If you look up on Amazon, a French pastry chef by the name of Jackie Pfeiffer. He's an Alsatian baker, so around Strasbourg, so that's why a Frenchman has a name like Pfeiffer. But he is one of the kind of world-known pastry chefs. And in his cookbook that he won a Beard Award for, actually the cookbook that came out a couple of years back, it was before the pandemic. And he has just a wonderful sablé recipe in that book.
I think I like them dipped in chocolate, or, you know, you can make them in different ways, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's a sablé dough is very, very versatile.
Uh-huh.
Ours, for example, we put cardamom in it, flavor it that way. But yeah, and sablé dough is used for tart shells, for cookies. It's a type of consistency. Sablé, the type of crumbling that it does, and the technique for getting the butter worked into it.
Mm, I need one right now with a cup of tea. I'd be good to go.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, speaking of recipes, you shared a couple. One was for a baguette, which I appreciate because it's day one and day two. Mm-hmm. In the baguette with Louvain. I think that means leaven. Is that right? The culture there?
Right. It's the yeast culture. Wild yeast culture.
Can you walk us a little bit through the day one and day two? Give us a sense of what's involved.
So, you know, day one, it will be familiar to anyone who does sourdough baking. You know, Louvain is sort of the French cousin, or our sourdough culture is the American cousin to the French Louvain. Day one is you're just getting the culture up and active. Louvain is, and as well as sourdough cultures, are these wonderful, wonderful self-balancing populations of about 30, at least 30 different microbes. 10 different yeast, the predominant one being Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is what we think of as bread yeast and brewer's yeast. And then at least 20 different bacteria. And so that culture needs to be fed. It's fed with flour. So you need to, it needs to be active. Often if, for, you know, our grandparents and great grandparents, they often kept these growing and they were growing every day. For a home baker now who may not do it every day, you need to at least take a day to get your yeast culture up and growing and active.
And this is your bread and butter, because I want to step in and say you hold a doctorate in yeast genetics.
Surprisingly, as that happened, it wasn't a connection that I made until later in life. So yeah, absolutely. I find it remarkably interesting from multiple perspectives. But yeah, but the most interesting perspective is the flavor that comes out of these fermentation processes. That, you know, all those microbes working together, they balance out the population, and each one has a different role to play. Right, the bacteria that are in natural, we think of sour cultures or Louvain cultures as yeast, but there's a lot of bacteria in there. They handle the really complex starches and mm-hmm. break it down, so that the yeast, who prefer simpler sugars, simpler starches, just like us, as our GI tract and as our physiology works, and they just do wonderful things. Mankind has, I mean, maybe the Louvain should have UNESCO designation.
I knew that was coming.
I'm not sure who you'd give credit for. I mean, that there's folklore around that whole thing, but yeah, exactly. So yeah, day one, getting those microbes up and running, having them happy and growing at a good speed, and having the population all balanced, and then using that culture to leaven your baguette. Traditionally, early on. Although, I mean, today a lot of baguette recipes only use quick rise yeast and powdered yeast, but early on, all bakeries used these Louvain. Mm. When times get tough, I think we can still go back to that. I know, for example, when the pandemic hit, We were going, the supply chains were getting stretched and there was no yeast, no quick rise yeast, which is used in other products. And so we re-jerry-rigged our, very quickly reworked our recipe so that we could use what we were growing in the shop to make sure we could keep the products running.
Wow. That's really interesting. Gene Webb runs two French style bakeries in Milwaukee's North Shore suburbs. Call in with your questions about the craft of bread making or share what you've learned in the kitchen. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On the heels of France's iconic long bread loaf, the baguette, achieving cultural heritage status, we explore the art of bread making. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Gene Webb is here, owner and head baker of North Shore Boulangerie with two locations in the Milwaukee suburbs. So, Gene, you know, how do you know you've got a good culture in day one of the recipe to take that sour culture into day two and be confident with it?
The easiest way is to, once you, on day one, as you're providing the culture with fresh water and fresh flour, you should start to see the culture expand. As the yeast and the bacteria grow and the yeast are producing CO2, you should see your culture within, I'd say, 2 hours or so. You should see it start growing. And actually, this is an excellent point. Whatever vessel you feed it in should be clean, without any soap or sterilization residue, because that'll harm the microbes. But it should also be big enough to allow the culture to expand so that you're not, your culture doesn't kind of overtop whatever jar you're putting it in. But yeah, within 2 to 3 hours, you should start seeing it rise up and grow and get bubbly.
Okay. I want to just jump in here with Tom in Dubuque, Iowa. Tom, hi, go ahead.
Hello, good morning. Pleasure listening to your show. I have both successfully and unsuccessfully baked bread before, but I wondered if you could give some recommendations on coming up with your own sourdough starter. And how best to feed that, and when, how long it can be stored in the refrigerator before use. Thank you.
Excellent questions. It's very satisfying to start your own sourdough culture, but you have to be very, very patient. As I mentioned before, it's a self balancing population of up to 30, maybe 40 microbes, depending on where you're at in the country. So when you first start, I mean, basically, if you just take a vessel with flour and water, it's a half flour, half water. That's considered by baker percentages to be 100% hydration. Microbes in the air will seed that flour and water mixture. But because the bacteria tend to grow much faster, they're much simpler and will initially outcompete any yeast that fall in there. Your culture will be quite frightening for about the first 2 weeks. It will smell terrible because bacteria don't really smell good to us. But persevere and don't run. In time, sometimes 2 weeks, sometimes 3 weeks, sometimes 4 weeks, the yeast will start to get a foothold. And then the population will balance out. You can help yourself a couple of ways to maybe help this process along a little bit faster. You can drop dried fruit or fresh fruit, organic, unwashed fruit into the culture, and sometimes a little bit of malt syrup, because the yeast like the simple sugars, whereas the bacteria like the more complex starches. And so how the fruit helps is that if you've ever been out in the orchard and you picked an apple and you look at it and it looks cloudy and you think it's just dust or dirt or schmutz, and you polish it on your shirt and eat the apple, that film, most of it is actually wild yeast. So if you can get an organic fruit that has not been washed, and drop it in, you're actually inoculating the culture with these wonderful wild yeast. So you can help the process along, but really it's be brave, persevere. And in time, it may take a couple of weeks, but that culture will balance itself out. That does mean that every couple of days, you're going to start with a fresh vessel with flour and water, 50-50, and then add a little bit of the previous culture. It's important to keep feeding it fresh, but it will, as I said, in a couple of weeks, give you a beautiful Lavan or sourdough culture that is quite specific to your region, the terroir of that of your area, and will give you a wonderful bread.
Tom, does that help?
It does very much. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. We only have a few moments left, but I just want to acknowledge the other recipe you sent along our way. Find them at WPR.org/mornings. But the French country white bread with fermented dough. Any highlights you can share about this recipe?
The fermented dough is probably the first way that bakers leaven bread. Yeah, and it's a pre-ferment like Lavan or sourdough. But it allows you to get started right away. You don't have an ongoing culture. You use dry yeast, make some dough, let it ferment, let the yeast grow, chill it, and then you use that chilled dough the next day to start in. And in those 24 to 48 hours, the solo kind of monoculture of S. cerevisiae will be able to undertake enough fermentation to provide you with a beautiful, beautiful flavor.
Okay, so would you consider that to be a bit of a gateway bread to bake to try out if you haven't been baking much before?
Right, absolutely, because it's the shape is it's a batard, so it can fit in your hand. It's not so intimidating to move around the kitchen. It's a tight crumb bread with a nice French crust, but not the really aggressive crust that you usually want in a baguette. So yeah, I think it is. I think it would be a wonderful gateway drug.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Gene, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Gene Webb is owner and head baker of North Shore Boulangerie. We have a link to the baguette. We have a link to the French country white bread recipes. They're on our program page, WPR.org/mornings, to check them out. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.
We'll be right back.